welcome to All the Best. I'm Meryn Winchester, and this episode, Sex, Drugs and Politics, we're going to tantalise you with tales of women in power. Yep, politics just got interesting again. These are the stories of women bursting open the political arena, gangsters, drugs, love, pole dancing and controversy. Our first story was produced by Liam Kieram, and it was originally played in an episode we broadcast in December 2012. This is the story of pole dancing champion Zara Stardust, her taste of politics and her feminist ideology.
The first ever amateur competition I did was at Pure Platinum on Pitt Street, and I did the Divinals, I Touch Myself. And I had like my partner at the time there to watch me, and I think I came third or something like that. I got a prize and I was completely stoked with myself, and after that I was hooked. When I was working in a top tier law firm, I was teaching pole dancing at the same time. So by day I was doing law and by night I was doing pole. And during the daytime it just felt like I was in this place where I was in a concrete jungle. I was losing my flexibility really quickly because I had to sit in an office chair. They seemed to feel like creativity was wearing a lavender coloured tie with your suit. And this was for me coming from a place where I'd worn costumes where snap G-strings and giant wings and glitter and sequins and really drag-like makeup and, you know, this enormous stage performance, and people were constantly testing the bounds of their imagination. And so for me, I felt like it was such a stifling place. It was really hierarchical and I just cried all the time. And then at night time, I would go to the pole studio. Everyone would be in their pink polka dot hot pants upside down, you know, and it was a place where there were all these women there where you could feel good about yourself and about the world and spread love and spread peace. And it felt like you were actually making a difference to people's lives and making the world a better place. I left and ran for Parliament for the Australian Sex Party straight afterwards, which caused kind of scandal and celebration at the same time. I met one of the senior associates from my firm when I was on the hustings handing out how to vote condoms. I wasn't sure what to do, so I handed him a condom. Turns out I got sent an email sometime later saying that indeed he had voted for sex. So actually, people were much more supportive than I had imagined, and it was the best thing I ever did, leaving law for pole. That's where my heart is. I'm a lifer in this industry, I think.
Here in the wild, we observe one of the most extraordinary of creatures. This exotic species of female is a notorious protagonist of the underground. She is loved and hated, adored and scorned. She is, of course, the pole dancer.
Some say pole originated from pagan Beltane rituals where people danced around maypoles to celebrate fertility. Pole was also popular thousands of years ago in India, called Mallakam, where it was predominantly a male sport. The poles were much thicker and they were made from wood and they had a little ball on the top. There's also a long history of circus pole, of Chinese pole within the circus. And in this genre, the poles are sticky, they're static and they're very high. Pole dancing, as it's known today in clubs, became popular in Canada and the United States during the 1980s. There are many different kinds of poles. They differ in their textures and their slip factors. You can get them in brass, titanium, chrome, stainless steel. You can get them from 38 millimeters to 50 millimeters, which is the international standard size. And we use a number of different grips to stick to the pole, from shaving cream, hairspray, dry hands, which is a kind of liquid chalk. Pole dancing actively resists stereotypes of feminine passivity, women as weak. And it's displays of agility, flexibility, strength, physical stamina. Maneuvering one's own body weight upside down with circus-like ease on a 38 to 50 mil pole is no easy feat. Pole dancers often supplement their skills with aerial training like trapeze, silks, lira. So contrary to these assumptions about women as docile or passive or weak, many pole dancers take great pride in our muscles and our core stability. And I often hear women joking proudly about trying clothes on in stores and not being able to get them over their lats or their delts because they have the shoulders and biceps of men, they say. And they take real pride in this. Pole events and competitions are patronised by an overwhelmingly female audience. This is the case for burlesque events, pole dancing events, and ladies' nights at strip clubs as well. In their book, The Porn Report, Alan McKee, Catherine Albury, and Catherine Lumby write that women are increasingly consuming sexually explicit material these days. And I think this translates into a range of genres, including pole. Miss Pole Dance Australia is performed for a predominantly female audience. Even in strip clubs, strippers often pay special attention to women in the audience. In her memoir, Strip City, Lily Barana writes that it takes real nerve for a woman to come into a strip club, and it's a form of female misbehaviour I think should be richly rewarded. I feel that there's an increasing amount of anti-stripper sentiment in the pole community. Recently, a pole competition commenced in Australia that attempted to limit entrance to those who are not exotic dancers. And after much outcry from the pole industry, they changed the criteria to be only open to reputable contestants. Another pole dancer I spoke to was asked to renounce her title from one competition after she mentioned in a media interview that most of Australia's best pole dancers were indeed strippers, because the competition didn't want to be associated with that. The World Pole Dance Federation as well renounces any involvement with the sex industry and bans the winner from accepting any contracts that are erotic in nature. So when Susie Q was the runner-up of Miss Pole Dance Australia in 2008, her prize was meant to be to compete at the World Championships, but because the World Pole Dance Federation, whose motto is pure sport and art, reject any association with the sex industry, so she was asked to give up hosting Sexpo and told that if she won, that she would decline any contracts or endorsements with any companies that were in any way erotic. And while this has been really useful because it's made pole something that is accessible to the mainstream, I think it's really harmful when the fitness benefits of pole are used at the expense of stigmatizing other kinds of pole, and by extension, stigmatizing other kinds of women, other kinds of movements, and other kinds of work. Particularly in a world that continues to divide women into Madonna or whore, the pole dancing industry should be a space where women are united to celebrate all different kinds of expression. Pole is not striptease. It's not the same thing. And not all pole dancers are strippers. But they do have a really intertwined history. And pole doesn't need, I don't think, this overemphasis on fitness, like, I only do pole dancing for fitness, I'm not that kind of girl, in order to legitimate it, to rescue it from some kind of immoral, bacchanalian depravity. We need to stop running away from women's bodies and embrace all different kinds of female sexuality.
That story was produced by Liam Kiram, and it was a story of Zara Stardust. You're listening to All the Best, and this episode is Sex, Drugs, and Politics. Our next story is told by Catherine Bendel, and it was recorded at Tales of Sin and Virtue, a live storytelling event hosted by All the Best. I'll let Catherine reveal to you all the sin and virtue of her life in government. This story contains drug references.
Well, this is a true story, and it starts some time ago. I was 20 years of age and when I met Ishtavan. And I walked into the roundhouse at the University of New South Wales, and there was, to my eyes anyway, one of the most exotic creatures I had ever seen. I was very virtuous. I was actually a virgin, and I was studying social work. doesn't get any better than that, does it? And there was this very exotic man. He was slightly older than me, and he was smoking cigarillos and drinking double coffee shots, which was absolutely unheard of in those days. Anyway, I had just come back from my first Vietnam, anti-Vietnam demonstration, and I was wearing my Mary Quant false eyelashes and my favourite Indian mirror dress. That's how radical I was. And it was the clash of two cultures. He was a refugee from Hungary. He'd come out in 1956 when the Russians had invaded Budapest, and he was totally apolitical and was not interested in any way, but thought it was really funny that this little social worker was going off and protesting. Anyway, we were married a couple of years later, and we were married to the anthem of its time, which was this huge advertising campaign for the Australian Labor Party at the time, headed by Gough Whitlam. And it was really one of the most exciting times in Australian politics. We'd had something like 23 years of Conservative government, and the Labor Party was coming in to make all these enormous reforms. Anyway, so most of you would know your history and know that within 2 years of that, the Whitlam government was dismissed. And like a lot of very angry Australians at the time, I went off and joined the local branch of the Australian Labor Party with a baby in tow. Now, the local branch of the Labor Party happened to be the smallest branch of the Labor Party in Australia. It was in Hunters Hill. Now, for people here who don't know where Hunters Hill is, it's a little peninsula that juts into Sydney Harbour, and it's famous for three things. One is it has the highest density of lawyers and judges and real estate agents than any other place in Sydney, but it also has, per capita, the highest density of public housing, which is a real surprise to most people. It's like shitloads of Housing Commission people live there. And the other thing that's really interesting about Hunters Hill, or was interesting about Hunters Hill at the time, was it had the oldest operating psychiatric hospital in Australia. And all those people could vote. Anyway, so I went off and joined the local branch, and it was tiny. So it only took me a couple of, well, months really, before I sort of worked my way through the ranks and became the secretary of the local branch. I can't tell you how exciting it was being a young woman with a baby and being the secretary of the Australian Labor Party branch in Hunters Hill. I got to write to... Oh, thank you. Thank you. Julia Gillard, eat your heart out. Honestly. Anyway, so I got to write all these incredible letters to everyone, telling them how they should be operating the balance of trade and bring the soldiers home from Vietnam, etc., etc. But my very, very favourite thing that I loved doing as a virtuous woman was to write to the local council telling them about all the things that they were doing wrong. Absolutely everything. All their planning decisions were wrong, all their playgrounds were wrong, they didn't have enough of this and enough of that. But the thing that I loved doing was I loved writing those letters to the local building inspector who worked on the council. And I would start every letter to him, "Comrade Building Inspector." And it would really piss him off. And then I would sign every letter, "Fraternally yours," or "In solidarity, comrade." Anyway, I found out later he hated me. He absolutely hated me. So time went on and I was really enjoying the role. And by this stage, I'd had another little baby. And it was suggested to me that maybe I could think about going into local government. And I thought, well, why don't I stand as the first ever endorsed ALP candidate for Hunters Hill Council? And I decided to have a go. And then this really weird thing happened. I got candidate's disease. Now, what candidate's disease means is that I turned into this compulsive door knocker. I couldn't help myself. As soon as I saw a door, I'd knock on it and I'd ask people to vote for me. Anyway, I'd go out every single day, a virtuous woman. I'd take my two little children with me, two little boys. They were very little and very small. And I'd put them on these leather leads. You know the ones I'm talking about? Do you know those ones? You had one. Yeah, well, it was really funny because I had the both of them on these leads and I'd sort of go around and I'd be door knocking and always had to be home by 3 o'clock for play school. But anyway, so we were door knocking and people would come up to me and say, I can't believe you're walking around with those children on a lead. You know, it makes them look like puppies. And of course, I can't tell you how little I took any notice of what they said. All I can say is that they're both in their 30s now and they're incredibly loyal. And so, I don't know, maybe there's some relation, I don't know. Anyway, so this particular day we're out door knocking and we get to this one house and we climb up the stairs and there's this fly screen door and it's full of bullet holes, except I didn't know that. I thought it was some sort of really creative fly screen. I had no idea. Anyway, so to the door comes this man and on either side of him are these two huge goons, huge like thugs. Anyway, they take one look at me and look at him and then look at these two kids and I've got them wrapped up in leather, right, with these leather thongs. And this man in the middle, well, he just, as I said, takes one look at me and he falls absolutely madly in love with me right then. And I think it was because he thought, oh, at last a woman who knows how to treat the men in her life. Well, it turned out this guy was one of the biggest criminals in Australia's history. If you've been watching the Underbelly series, he gets quite a lot of mentions in Underbelly. Well, it turns out he lived in Hunter's Hill. It was this great big secret. So he takes one look at me and he says to me, don't you worry about campaigning anymore, little lady. I'll take care of that. Sin. 2 weeks later, I get elected to the council. In the biggest landslide vote in Hunter's Hill history, I got a 7% swing. Tony Abbott can't even dream of a 7% swing. So I get elected to the Hunter's Hill Council, and there I am. And all the time, back in the background, is Ishtaban urging me on, incredibly proud of me, and so happy that I found this wonderful life in politics. And I did. I loved politics. I could see all the changes, all the wonderful things that you could do that you can't do as a social worker, all these massive changes. I was so inspired. And so here I was on the council having the time of my life, except for, guess who? The building inspector. His hatred of me had grown exponentially by this stage. What I forgot to mention was we were in the heart of John Howard's seat, and John Howard at those days used to just be the opposition leader but had great visions one day of being the Prime Minister, and the building inspector adored him. So here I was, and he made my life an absolute misery on the council, but most of the time I loved it. And I started to think, wow, this is really exciting being a woman in politics. Maybe, just maybe, I could go to the next level. Maybe I could just go into state politics and really start to make a difference. And I started thinking about, as a woman would, what I'd wear on my first day when I went into the New South Wales Parliament. What dress would I wear for my maiden speech? And just as life couldn't get more perfect, I got a phone call from Stephen, from Ishtaban. You see, a couple of weeks before, he'd found a lump. And we thought it was terribly funny and we both laughed about it for hours. But he'd just been to the doctors and he was crying. He had cancer and it was very serious. In fact, it was so serious that the doctor was putting him into hospital the next day. It was testicular cancer. We didn't know much about testicular cancer in those days. They didn't know how to treat it. All they knew were the secondaries were lung cancer. He was 29 years of age, and our lives came to an end, to a dead stop. So he started the treatment. He went into hospital. He had his testes removed, and he started the treatment. And in those days, they didn't know how to do it very well, so they gave them everything. So he had massive doses of chemotherapy, massive doses of radiotherapy. And in less than 2 weeks, his hair started to fall out. He lost weight and he started to look like a person who was dying. And after those 2 weeks, he came home and he said to me, "Forgive me. Please forgive me. But I can't go on with this. I would rather die than continue." And I was so angry and so upset that the next day I went straight up to the oncology unit at Royal North Shore, and I stood there and I demanded to see the head oncologist. And after about 20 minutes he came out and he said, "I know who you are and I know why you're here. We have tried everything with your husband. He is reacting really badly to these drugs. We can't stop the nausea. I'm sorry about that. There's just nothing we can do. We've given him injections, we've given him tablets." And I'm standing there saying, he is 20, in his 20s. He has two small children. I have a huge political career in front of me. And this is all stopping. And he said, "I'm sorry, Catherine, there's nothing I can do." And as he turned around to leave, he said, "Look, there is one thing that might work, but it's illegal. It's marijuana. We know that if some people smoke marijuana, it seems to control the nausea." And with that, he left. So I went home, and it's, as I said, I was 28, I think. I was 28 at the time. I had two small children. I had a husband who looked like he was going to die. And I had this enormous political career in front of me that wasn't going to happen. So I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to become a drug lord. And that's exactly what I did. That afternoon, I rang a friend who worked at Macquarie University. He said, "I can get enough dope to tide you over." I went up to Coles and I bought every Jiffy Pot I could find. And I bought hoses and I bought fertilizer and I bought gardening tools, and I came home that afternoon, I dug up my entire backyard and I planted dope from one end of my backyard to the other. And I found out I had this new talent. I grow great dope. Shitloads of it. Absolutely shitloads of it. Dope hide up with great big thick heads on it. It was just amazing, amazing, amazing. And all the neighbours, they were all in on it. You know, we used to have a lot of barbecues in our backyard, and people used to come over, and we stopped talking about how tall the kids were. We talk about how tall the dope was. And my neighbour next door, he was a mad gardener, so he'd rush home from work and hose over the fence and water the crop. And after a while, life got better. Stephen smoked the dope, Ishtaban smoked the dope. He went back to work and he seemed to be doing really well. I used to come home from the council meetings and he'd be sitting there watching the test pattern, eating a Mars bar, saying, "You should have watched this show." But he was happy and so was I. And so I started to think again about this political career. And all the time in the background was the building inspector. What happens in the council is that about 3 or 4 days before the council meeting, the council papers are delivered to the councillors to read. And they're usually quite big, sort of about that tall, take a couple of days to read. These are all the applications coming before council. And in our little council, the papers were delivered to the front door by the ranger. But this particular afternoon, the ranger was sick. And the building inspector was sent round with the council papers. And normally they're delivered to the front door, but this time they were delivered to the back door. How did I know? Because there were the council papers on the back step with a handwritten note from the building inspector. "Congratulations on your tomato plants, councillor. See you at the meeting tomorrow night." I knew right then, right there, that my political career was over. I was no longer a woman of virtue. I was a drug peddler and a dope grower. So what did I do that night? Well, I did what any Russian peasant would do. I put a scarf on my head and went out with a sickle under a full moon, and I cut down that entire marijuana crop, the entire lot. I did. I took it inside. I dried it out in the oven. And the next morning, I called a courier company. To this day, that courier company doesn't know that that 1 kilo parcel wrapped in brown paper that they took to the oncology unit at Royal North Shore Hospital was the same stuff that's normally found in boogie boards at Bali Airport. But that was the end of my political career. He never said a word to me, and I never said a word to him. I spent the rest of my time on the council very quietly and waited out my time to leave. And I did. He never stood again for the council himself. He was a paid employee, and he disappeared at the end of that council term. It turns out that some of the other councillors had suspicions about his behaviour on the council, so he decided to resign and leave. Our marriage didn't survive that time. Stephen and I parted less than a year after all of that. It was just too much for two very young people to go through. But he's still alive. He lives up in the Hunter Valley. He's been in remission over 30 years now. And he's very proud of the fact that I go around and tell that story. But that was the end of my political career. And it gave me some of the best stories of my life. And I want to thank you for letting me tell you one of them tonight. Thank you.
That was Catherine Bendall sharing her story about local government, a young family, and her talent for horticulture. Thank you to all of our contributors to this episode for sharing their stories. All the Best is produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN in Melbourne, Radio Adelaide and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Our production manager is Carly-Ann Keneally, our executive producers are Jordana Caputo and Belinda Lopez, and I'm Maren Winchester, the Features Executive Producer. If you have a story to share, contact us at allthebestradio.com. Catch us next week for more homegrown stories from around Australia.